As lawmakers are gathering for a special session to try to resolve the budget impasse, we're about to enter its third year. Today we ask, what is this costing you?
Comes to about $906 per person. Plus, we pay interest on the backlog, and we've been losing ground on the state's pension obligations.
WBEZ Chicago reporter Dan Weissman joins us to explain. Plus, Rockford lost about 1.3 billion gallons of water last year, and that's just a drop in the bucket compared to the amount being lost across the country.
Nationwide, water infrastructure especially needs a pretty significant investment over the next, two decades.
Rockford Water Superintendent Kyle Saunders explains what's being done to decrease water loss. And before Roe versus Wade, some religious leaders formed a secret network to refer women to doctors for unwanted pregnancies. We're going to speak with the authors of a new book about how that was created and its relevance today. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have you ever wondered how much our 722-day-long budget impasse is costing you as an each individual taxpayer? And perhaps an even more basic question, are you wondering who's getting paid and who isn't? But the big question, how much is this costing all of us? WBEZ Chicago reporter Dan Weissman has been looking into this, as it turns out, for years. And he's in our Chicago studio with me now at the Medill Newsrooms in downtown Chicago. Hey, Dan. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla. Great to be here.
It's kind of depressing that you first did this story a year ago, and now where you're back updating this again, how much this is costing all of us.
That is true.
Why did you want to figure out how much our budget impasse is costing each individual taxpayer?
You know, I saw it cited in the newspaper. This is costing us at least a grand each. And I was like, really? And so I wanted to check the math and, if I was true, put the story out.
And so that math was as what you could figure.
Yeah,
pretty correct. $1,000 a person.
Yeah.
And for what time period? Is that like it's just costing us $1,000 a year?
No. This is it's costing us $1,000 so far.
Okay. So far
since we started not having a budget. Just the not having a budget has cost us $1,000 each.
Every person who lives in Illinois.
Man, woman, child, yeah. Everybody.
And how did you come to that number?
So when we
this is not an easy number to cut to, I imagine.
I got help carrying all the zeros. A guy named Todd Ely is a public policy professor in Colorado. He's an expert in municipal finance. I've talked with him before. So I basically called him in for help. But the basic isn't so hard. When we started, you can see our backlog of bills as a state was like $4.4 billion.
3 years ago. Almost
2 years ago, right?
Right.
Going into year three.
Oh, going into, right, correct.
So 2 years, just about 2 years ago. And I asked the comptroller, that's how I say it. Some people say controller. What's the tab? What do you estimate the tab's going to be, our bill backlog, the amount of money we owe that we haven't paid yet, we know we got to pay, by June 30th? And they were like $16 billion. So I was like, that's about $11.5 billion. How many people we got in the state? Ask the census that. We did that math. And then that came to about $906 per person. But we pay interest at almost like 12% a year on most of what we owe. So tack that on. And then we've fallen farther behind in various ways on our enormous backlog of pension obligations. So 1,000 is really, really conservative.
Right, because it doesn't even include all of the pension stuff.
I mean, we were like, look, it's going to be a lot more than this. Let's just call it a grand.
Right. And the interest part is, I think, I want to just focus on that for a second, because I think everyone needs to understand, like with the credit ratings, the more our credit goes into the toilet, the bigger interest rates that we pay.
Well, this is – so there's such a good question, and we can go straight into the weeds if you want. But there's two things. And one is we have a law called the Prompt Payments Act that says when a bill – just like I'm a dentist. I treated a state employee who's insured by the state. Here's my bill. And it doesn't get paid for I think it's like 90 days. Then I'm owed interest on that like 1% a month. That accumulates. The other thing, which is absolutely right, like when we borrow.
The cost of our borrowing.
The cost of our actual borrowing, that also goes up, right? That was when we're like, hey, we need to borrow a couple billion dollars to build some roads. Another long story. The bond market, the people who buy bonds are like, yeah, we're going to need a little more interest from you than we would from some more vanilla state like Minnesota.
Yeah, that's a great. So because we are I shouldn't laugh because it's a horrible situation.
What else are we going to do?
That is the right. Can you? So also a year ago, you asked a question. We're going to tweet out this story because you really took a really deep dive into this for WBEZ's Curious City, which was, where do our tax dollars go when there's not a budget? And what, if anything, are they funding? That's a really big question, but I think you do have a somewhat simple answer to that, right?
Well, you know, I think the most important answer is we are still spending all kinds of money. And in fact, we're spending more money than we're taking in. I mean, not having a budget, like if you don't have a budget for your household, it doesn't mean you don't have bills. It just means you don't have a plan to match the money you owe on your bills to the amount of money that's coming in from your job. And that's kind of where we are.
So you're saying that essentially not having a budget is also making it worse because we're spending more.
This is the $1,000 that we each owe is accumulated just from that problem, right? Is that we owe whatever else we owe in taxes, we owe $1,000 more apiece because we've been spending more than we're taking in as a state.
And then I think some people are also confused as to why we're still spending even though we don't have a budget.
Basically, there's a bunch of court orders or court cases where the courts are supervising that kind of say, like, look, these things you can't stop doing just because you don't happen to have had a budget. And the biggest one is Medicaid. We have to pay. The courts have ruled many years ago that we have to keep providing Medicaid services. So we're on the hook for that. There's some other services that are like that. And then the other is that state employees keep showing up to work and getting paid. And courts ruled, like, you haven't laid these people off. You haven't told them not to come to work. So they're going to come to work and you got to pay them. And so, you know, you add those things up, that's more than we're taking in.
Right. And so all of that actually adds up to essentially what's about 90% of what would have been a budget we're actually paying, right, through these consent decrees and court orders or other federal pass-through things as well, right?
I haven't looked at the 90% right. number, but yeah, probably about that.
And so I guess the question is, who determines the priority of what gets paid when there's not a budget to say what has to get paid, apart from, well, because obviously the courts are saying you have to pay this.
Right.
It's like this kind of crazy mishmash of all of these things going on, right?
It's a little bit of a juggling act. Right. Well, so the other thing we are paying for is K-12 education. The state pays a chunk of that.
Another huge chunk, right.
And that's that's the one thing the legislature has actually done its normal thing. It turns out there's no like one bill or law that's called the budget and here's all the spreadsheets. It's actually a series of what are called appropriations bills. It's a affirmative decision. We're going to spend this much for K-12 education, this much for universities. And they basically were like, we're going to do the K-12 education because otherwise all the schools shut down and everybody's mad at all of us. It's inescapable. So they've done that. So what did we decide? How do we decide what to pay when?
And who decides?
Who decides? Basically, the comptroller decides what we pay when. So that's their job. The comptroller is this kind of formally obscure state office. And this is the entire job, is to manage the cash flow.
And I was going to say, I don't think Susana Mendoza is not that obscure of a job the past couple of years anyway.
Not anymore, right? Because
right.
It's suddenly the most important job in the state, you could argue, because here's the money coming in from, like, here's today's receipts from sales taxes. Here's the quarterly income tax that came in June. And, like, then she's got to sit down and be like, okay, and there's this giant payment I have to make into our state pension fund. Here's a giant payment we have to make to the bond market. Here's payroll for the state employees. Here's the date that we've promised to give money to K-12 education. And then here's that dentist bill from the guy who treats state employees. And here's the doctor's bill from Medicaid. And all of them go in a queue. And there's a whole pecking order. It's like first in, first out, except that you have to pay certain things on time, like the bond payments, or else – I don't know. The world falls apart.
Yeah, I was going to say, we haven't even – what would happen if we didn't pay our bond payments?
You know, let's really hope we don't find out about
right?
that.
Right, because that's something we don't want to do, right?
It would be bad. I mean, the question is, like, is Illinois too big to fail, I think is the kind of question the bond market is asking these days. We become Puerto Rico. We become Detroit. Like, it's not a world we want to enter into. We're already in weird enough territory. But so far that's been it. And so that then – like, one thing I found out is that the comptroller is like you would if you had a bunch of bills that you had to pay, or if you're going to get kicked out of your apartment if you don't pay your rent on the first, then, like, the week before the first of the month, you, like, don't buy any cigarettes or potato chips
because you need to pay your rent.
You need to pay the rent.
Right.
So,
and that's essentially what's happening on a state level.
Yes.
For 2 years.
Yeah.
That's WBEZ Chicago's Dan Weissman in studio with me. We're talking about reporting he's done, not just on the individual cost to taxpayers, but how much he's basically kind of – you're kind of breaking down the whole mess that we're in. I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation as well because lawmakers are meeting for special sessions. Governor Rauner has called those. You know, in a speech on Tuesday night – well, a speech, it was a couple-minute conversation. He said that this may be one of the most important legislative sessions in Illinois history – Let's go now to Tom Lisi. He's the government watchdog reporter for the Herald Review based in Decatur. Hey, Tom, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's nice to be a part of this inspirational conversation we have here.
Yeah, the inspirational conversation of how terrible our finances are, right, Tom? Because when, and this is supposed to be being solved by this special session that Governor Rauner has called. I think in most people's minds, when I think special session, I think, okay, they're all in Springfield. They're all together working all day trying to solve this. Is that what happened yesterday?
Well, in a sense, I mean, they're not all together. You know, when they meet in special session there, I guess they're really supposed to just, you know, they do have an official session that day where they are on the floor. But yesterday that lasted for about 7 minutes. And then they went to committees, they went to caucus, which means, you know, the separate parties go their own ways to another room, and they strategize and they talk about, you know, what they're going to do as far as, you know, really it comes down to the budget, right? So
the official session, Tom, was 7 minutes.
Yeah, yesterday. Yeah. So, you know, you have Senate President John Cullerton, who's, you know, really been pretty outspoken about how he's kind of bitter about the fact that the Democrats passed a budget plan during the regular session. And he sort of suggested that, you know, why do we have to come back? We did our job. So you have that going on in the Senate. You have House Speaker Mike Madigan, of course, who, you know, sort of makes the kind of big decisions about where to go. And so, you know, today they're on what's called Committee of the Whole. So this is something that Speaker Madigan and the Democrats organize, where basically, you know, in a legislative group, you know, any legislature, Congress, the Senate in Congress, you have your committees, transportation, agriculture, appropriations, that stuff. This would basically be just one big giant committee in the House chamber where everybody's
there. Okay,
so
they're all actually meeting. So with the hopes that hopefully they're having conversations about how to actually to work together
well,
to pass a budget.
You know, it
well,
really,
that
mean,
sounds like a no.
You know, it's kind of more theater if you really want to kind of get down to it. I mean, today they're supposed to hear from people who have been affected by, you know, injuries at work and sort of how workers' compensation policies affected them. And so this is all orchestrated by the Speaker and the House Democrats. And, of course, the Republicans are sort of saying this is sort of just a bunch of show. And, you know, this has been going on for 2.5 years plus, and, you know, the negotiations around this. And, you know, people know where the other side stands at this point and what's at stake. So, you know, it is kind of weird that they're having these sort of informational committee sessions.
Right, in the middle of the special sessions that the governor has finally called. That's Tom Lisi. He's a government watchdog reporter for the Herald Review. He's on the line from Decatur. Here with me in Chicago, Dan Weissman with WBEZ Chicago. Dan, I wanted to mention, as we're talking about the whole mess of everything, you spoke with State Senator Daniel Biss, who chairs the Human Services Committee. Of course, we should add he's running for governor. He's also, though, a former math professor at the University of Chicago.
Yep.
So when he shows you what he calls this sad little spreadsheet, I feel like I should pay attention to what that is.
The guy knows his numbers. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. This is a year and a half.
Right.
Ago,
so he left his career. Just to be clear, he left a career as a math professor at the University of Chicago to go into state office.
State politics.
Right.
Yeah. And this is just a spreadsheet that he basically asked for and got that showed like $100,000 is owed to this social service agency, like $200,000 is owed to that group. And it added up to a big chunk of money, I think $1.5 billion that he had. And it wasn't a comprehensive list.
That was just for Human Services.
It was just for Human Services from one chunk, one cut. This was a snapshot in time. And this was money that is not counted. We talked about that bill backlog.
Right.
These were bills that were not recognized in that backlog. These were invoices that had been sent to the Illinois Department of Human Services that, because there's no appropriation to pay them, the state was like, well, we're just not paying that, so we can't send it over to the comptroller as a bill.
So that's another $1.5 billion that's not even in the backlog that Comptroller Mendoza gave you.
Correct. Right. And we should note that, like, this is a year and a half ago, and since then what happened was about a year ago, they enacted a stopgap spending bill – that essentially caught up a bunch of that money.
Some of it, but not 100%.
A bunch of it, not 100% of it. Like what got left in and what got left out is very complicated. But it ended January 1st. And so that money has been piling up, those bills, which nobody has
any
intention
to pay. Right, so we're 6 months into June 22. We're now 6 months into another set of human services bills.
And last week, an appellate court ruled in a case where a bunch of these agencies have been suing and saying, like, you should pay us anyway. The court was like, nah, no, that's not going to happen. So they're stuck. And now they are. I've been talking to heads of some of these agencies as they decide whether to sign new contracts for FY18. And it is heartbreaking.
Right, because these are different social service agencies that you're
talking
to.
Right, different social services. So like the head of essentially a senior citizen services agency that provides services southwest of Aurora, she's been in this job 30 years. She's had conversations over the last – like there was a payday where she had to sit down, like, it's a wonderful life, where Jimmy Stewart's like, how much do you need? And she told her employees, this is how much I got. And they had to tell her, like, this is my rent. Can I have this much for this week? These people make $8.75 an hour.
To help senior citizens across Illinois.
She rated – this is in the Fox Valley area. She rated her own retirement account for $35,000, for which she has not been paid back by the agency. She's 74 years old.
Wow. To help cover.
Yeah.
So that is some of the costs of what we're dealing with on 722 days without a budget. I want to thank Dan Weissman from WBEZ Chicago, all the reporting he's done. We're going to tweet out all of those links, not just the individual bills, the long explainer he has about how the budget is funded and not in this kind of chaotic situation that we're in. So follow us at 21ST Show for that. Dan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Donna.
I want to thank Tom Lisi with us as well, a government watchdog reporter for the Herald Review. Tom, I know you're keeping an eye on this issue as well, how it's affecting folks in Decatur. Thanks for being with me, too.
Thanks for having me.
As I said, all this information will be on our website. If you want to know more, you can always tweet your comments to us as well. Our handle is 21STShow. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
Tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last year, the city of Rockford's water division pumped 6.4 billion gallons of water from its local wells to the city's customers. But about 20%, that's 1.3 billion gallons of that water, went unaccounted for and never made it. This isn't just a problem in Rockford. Across the country, an estimated 2.1 trillion gallons of water is lost each year. What's causing this issue? In a moment, we're going to be joined by an industry expert who's going to tell us more about how water loss is affecting communities across the U.S., the role climate change is playing in all of this. But first, we're joined on the phone by Kyle Saunders. He's the water superintendent with the city of Rockford. Kyle, thanks for being with me on the 21st. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So when we see 1.3 billion gallons of water, that's a pretty big number. Is that all like leaking through pipes? Is that where that water went?
No. And, you know, obviously when you're talking about water loss, you know, the two biggest things to remember is the difference between real loss and apparent loss. You know, real loss being the actual water that leaked from the infrastructure, whether it be pipes or reservoirs, and then the actual apparent loss, which is losses, you know, resulting from unauthorized consumptions, metering inaccuracies, you know, certain billing errors, and just trying to kind of hone in on each of those to really get a firm unaccounted for water number.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you guys been tracking this? I imagine this is something that's sort of a constant struggle that you're working with the city.
Yeah, I mean, historically, we've you know, in recent years, we've always been calculating it. But really in 2014 is when we started the journey of trying to proactively address some of our issues. In 2014, we had a 24% unaccounted for water number. And at that point, we decided that, you know, we needed to start somewhere. So first part of 2015, we conducted a pilot study of about 100 miles of leak detection in our northwest area of our zone. So starting in 2015, we began that pilot program, and then through the last 2 years, we're going through a much more robust program, trying to go through our zone systematically over the next few years.
That's Kyle Saunders. He's the water superintendent with the city of Rockford. I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation as well. Will Jernigan is the director of water efficiency with Cavanaugh Solutions, somewhat of an industry expert on all of this. Will, thanks for being with us. How, as you're hearing Kyle describe Rockford, is this pretty typical a situation of infrastructure and water loss across not just Illinois, but the country?
Thanks for having me. Absolutely. I would say it is. And I think Kyle said it well, talking about the different types of loss that can occur. And I think that's important as a starting point for when folks are thinking about this issue. Leakage from our pipe network, that's the one that we most commonly associate with. But water loss can manifest through metering and data systems that miss water and the measurement of that water and how it's billed. And then also people can steal water, so theft can occur. Why is all of that important, and is that typical? Absolutely. It's important to be able to understand to what extent each of those things is occurring in a water system, because attacking the issue requires kind of breaking it down into those respective parts. Because one approach, as Kyle mentioned, doing a survey, an acoustic survey, looking for leakage is not going to obviously be effective at addressing theft or data issues or metering issues. So breaking that down, definitely it's very common. In fact, every system experiences all of those things. The only thing that varies is the extent, the total size of their loss issues and the extent of leakage versus metering-related issues versus theft.
Kyle, is theft a big problem in the Rockford area?
We are not, from the numbers we're seeing and kind of some of our experience over recent years, we're not predicting that to be a large proponent of our overall loss. But it's something that, you know, we're obviously taking a look at and making sure that we're doing a better job coordinating our hydrant meter permits, understanding, you know, what type of authorized uses versus unauthorized uses, and just kind of understanding how those fit into the larger framework.
And Kyle, obviously, I think people who are listening are thinking, well, this is bad because no one wants to waste water. But does this also end up costing customers more?
I mean, there's a significant cost associated with, you know, actual real losses, because obviously it takes a certain amount of O&M cost to produce those gallons of water that we'd be losing. And, you know, through the programs that we've developed over the last couple of years and we've implemented, you know, we're seeing significant savings by addressing these proactively. And the payback period of these programs that we've been deploying is, you know, under a year. And those savings do compound. So, you know, yes, water loss does cost a certain amount on our O&M budget, but it helps by trying to be more proactive in addressing them before they become an issue.
And O&M is your budget, the city's
budget.
Operating and maintenance budget, right. Okay.
And
so I know we've talked to folks, for example, at the Illinois State Water Survey. Let's tackle the one problem of infrastructure, first of all, as we're going through all of these pieces of this. How much of infrastructure are you all able to get to every year? Because that seems like, I imagine with your staffing, that's not something that's feasible for you all within Rockford to be looking at the piping of the entire system every year.
Right. Our system in Rockford comprises approximately 850 miles of water main. Right now, we've broke down our surface detection program into four quadrants. So we're going to step through our system 25% a year over the next 4 years, and that's obviously going to become cyclical and just going to fall into the normal operating procedures that we employ. One of the big steps that we're doing this year as well as leak detection is we're doing master meter validation. And what that means is we're going to be looking at our actual production meters to ensure that the water that we say we're pumping out into the system is in fact being registered accordingly. Because obviously sometimes, you know, it's not usual, but, you know, you can overcompensate or undercompensate for the water that's going out into the system. And then the last component of this year's efforts is going to be a large meter testing component. So what we're looking at is some of our largest consumers and ensuring that their meters are appropriately installed. They have appropriate up and downstream lay lengths. They're the right meter for the application, and just ensuring that those large meters are working in a way that they should be. When you talk about kind of overall resources, a lot of these efforts were complementing our internal efforts with outside resources. So we're working with a vendor right now that's assisting our day-to-day operations with each of those components. So from a staffing standpoint internally, we're still able to obviously maintain our current efforts, and we're only increasing our output over the next couple years.
And Kyle, do you think the city of Rockford has enough funding to cover this? Is this something where this is a challenge in terms of trying to find the funding for solving these things? It sounds like you're also partnering with lots of other folks as well.
Yeah, I mean, from a funding standpoint, the actual work in doing the surface correlating, the large meter testing, and the meter validation, it is very economical because we're working with the same vendor to do all three. Obviously, addressing some of those concerns can have a certain cost component. We've been very fortunate over the last year and a half or so that we had a mild winter. So in terms of main breaks and some of those, you know, emergency repairs being down, we're able to take that savings and invest in some of these proactive measures.
That's a water superintendent from Rockford, Kyle Saunders. We're talking about water loss across cities. Last year, the city of Rockford pumped about 6.4 billion of gallons of water. About 1.3 of that went unaccounted for. This is a problem lots of cities deal with across the country. Will Jernigan's on the line with us as well. Will, Kyle mentioned winter and having things break and things like that. I wonder, as we're looking at climate change in particular, temperature changes, what kind of impact does that have on the infrastructure and water loss?
Well, it's a great question. It absolutely does have this strong potential to have an impact, and I think we're observing it. The examples that Kyle was talking about, I know that certainly in Wisconsin, they had a very well-documented increase in breaks over the winter. I believe it was 2014 or 2015. That was a very, very widespread issue. I think it also occurs on the flip side, where extended droughts, such as in California, the western states, actually Maine and the Northeast right now, we're seeing those types of issues affect, which has an impact on supply and supply reliability. So you get to the question of managing loss within a system. It's actually a strategy for mitigating future needs of supply. If you can reduce leakage, it offsets the amount of water you have to extract from the source. So it really, the potential for climate change to have impacts on water utility operations is kind of coming at them on both sides, on the winter extremities as well as the heat and the potential for drought.
Right. And when Kyle is also talking about working with different people, I wonder how much of solving this problem is something that falls upon cities versus utility companies. Where do we sort of see the work between who's sort of responsible for fixing these problems?
Sure. Well, let me start by saying I think the word fix is probably not the correct word to think about or to use in this context. I think the better word is to manage and control, because as I'm sure Kyle could attest to, these issues of system aging and inefficiencies, leakage, meters losing accuracy over time, it's not the type of thing that's a one-time fix. You check it off and it's done. It's a management issue. It's something you have to stay on with annual and recurring practices. So that kind of ties back to your question of how are people tackling it. I would say it's very much a blend. We're seeing a lot of utilities to water systems develop in-house programs, maybe with some outside help, in some cases not at all, completely internal. And typically the smaller the systems get, the more they tend to rely on outside knowledge or outside help or extension of staff and those types of things. But I would say the burden addressing it and putting those management systems in place, I mean, of course, lies with the utilities. They're running the systems, and they need to make the decision that's in their best interest, and of course, in their ratepayers' best interest. But we're definitely seeing a blend of internal and external resources kind of from system to system.
And that said, Will, I mean, how much water loss then do you think is acceptable in terms of, I wonder if you could put it in context, how much is just sort of a natural water loss? Like, I don't know if there's a percentage or, I mean, sure, when we're talking about trillions of gallons that we're losing every year, I wonder.
Yeah. And honestly, that's probably the most common question that I hear out working in the industry. The short answer is it's not zero. And I'd like to go ahead and get that one out of the way. That's not technically feasible for a system to experience no loss. It's also not financially responsible. Kyle was speaking to cost benefit and payback and what are we investing to pursue and reduce loss versus what we're recovering. And that really is sort of at the crux of your question there is what is an acceptable level of loss? What is appropriate? What should I be targeting? Those types of things. And at the end of the day, it gets back to this cost-benefit relationship. If Rockford invested to get their loss levels down very, very low, they may actually end up spending more than they would get back. And there's a relationship between the cost to operate and run a system and the water bills for the customer. So they have to be stewards of their ratepayers and consider what's economically appropriate. All that said is, the appropriate level of water loss is going to be a lot like the question of what should a system's water rates be. And that becomes very much a system-specific type of question because costs are very system-specific. Rockford has a specific cost to acquire and deliver safe water, and that's not the same cost as Macon, Georgia, or Tucson, Arizona, as an example. So the context of where a water utility is in terms of supply availability and cost to operate is really going to drive it, and it becomes a system-specific problem.
Right. So for us, Will, I imagine being here, having the Great Lakes, having Lake Michigan, having an abundant, it's probably a different calculation than, as you're saying, a place like Arizona.
That's right. That's right. And, I mean, even two utilities in the Great Lakes area could have very, very different cost profiles. You could have someone who has groundwater wells that have a very, very low cost to produce. You could have the next system down the street who is purchasing all of their water, and every million gallons of leakage that they experience is fairly expensive because they're buying it. They're having to buy it to acquire it. So the cost profile is really what becomes the driver there. And that's actually why it's inappropriate and not best practice or considered best practice to have a universal target where you say all water systems should be at this certain level, because you'll end up way over investing in some cases, and in other cases you'll end up way under investing, leaving a lot of money on the table for utility to pursue what would be economically appropriate.
Kyle, from your perspective, I wonder what you want citizens in Rockford to know about this issue in terms of thinking about, not just from us, we're talking about not just the environmental costs, but as taxpayers, what do you want citizens to know about this?
And I think the biggest thing, as Will mentioned, is, you know, we at the City of Rockford are trying to be good stewards of our overall water utility. So understanding that, you know, over the next few years, we're going to be investing heavily but appropriately in addressing and minimizing our losses. And by doing that, you know, we're going to obviously start seeing a reduction in overall operating expenses, hopefully. Seeing that if we can limit losses, that'll provide us less runtime on some of our assets, less maintenance cost to produce that water. And then by doing that, that savings that we'll realize, we'll be able to then reinvest into our overall capital needs. As Will mentioned, nationwide, water infrastructure especially, needs a pretty significant investment over the next, you know, two decades. And, you know, we at the City of Rockford understand that, and that's why we're looking at kind of proactive and predictive measures to help us employ more capital and invest in our water infrastructure.
That's Kyle Saunders, Water Superintendent with the City of Rockford. I want to thank him, as well as Will Jernigan, who's the Director of Water Efficiency for Kavanaugh Solutions, for joining us to talk about this issue. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Before Roe versus Wade, when abortion was illegal or highly restricted in the U.S., women had few safe options to end unwanted pregnancies. Access to abortion is often seen as a polarizing religious issue, especially among conservative Christians. But decades ago, you might be surprised to learn that a group of middle-aged white male religious clergy members were outspoken abortion right advocates. Starting in 1967, across several cities in the U.S., including Chicago, more than 1,000 pastors, rabbis, and other religious leaders joined together to create a secret network to help women who wanted to terminate their pregnancies. It was called the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion. They gave guidance. They even helped put women on planes to other states or countries where the procedure was legal. And it's all the subject of a new book called To Offer Compassion, A History of Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion. Its co-authors, Pat Ralph and D.A. Dirk, are with me now. I should mention for those in the Chicago area, D.A. is giving a book talk this evening at the Seminary Co-op Bookstore in Chicago from 6 to 8 p.m. Pat, D.A., welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thanks
great to be here.
Thanks so much for having us.
Dee, I wonder, can you take us back to 1967 and that time? Because I think, I imagine it was, most people might not think about the fact it was the 60s, and probably clergy were very divided along political lines in terms of being far left or far right.
Well, so interestingly, on the topic of abortion, we can talk more about this. Evangelicals weren't very active on the topic in the 60s, whereas liberal clergy, we would call them, were active in terms of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. And they knew each other through this network of sort of activist clergy. And that's how they got together on the topic of abortion. Many of them were campus clergy and had young women coming to them in distress in particular. And so it became apparent to them that this was a place where, you know, along with the burgeoning feminist and women's rights movement, that this was an area of need for women who were coming to them in cases of great distress. And so in 1967, that's when the network actually was founded in New York City.
It was founded in New York City. Pat, I wonder if you can tell us how it was founded and who founded it here in Chicago, because I think when you think about particularly the 60s and you think about politics in Illinois, I imagine that there was sort of bipartisan opposition to abortion. I'm thinking of the role of the Catholic Church within the Democratic Party, particularly in Illinois then. Can you tell us a little bit about how it got started in Chicago, Pat?
Yes. It had started in 1967 in New York City, and one of the main organizers was Reverend Howard Moody there in New York, who was an American Baptist minister, and he knew other American Baptist ministers who were liberal, as he was, and involved in civil rights and in anti-war activism. And one of those was Reverend Spencer Parsons, who at the time was the dean of Rockefeller Chapel at the University of Chicago. And really, it wasn't difficult to set up such a service. All they really required was to set up a telephone answering machine and take calls, train their clergy to do the counseling, and find out-of-state licensed physicians that would be willing to perform the abortions. Once they had found the doctors, that was really the hardest part. So Moody did kind of badger Spencer Parsons to get started with a clergy consultation service in Chicago. Spencer Parsons called together about 40 clergy that he knew who were also involved in the same issues, and they came together and would take call. There would be two or three clergy people on call each week. Women would call a telephone answering line that just had an outgoing message telling them which clergy were available, and they'd make their own appointment and see the clergy person in person. So that was another rule of the group. They'd see the women in person, refer them out of state to out-of-state doctors to confuse jurisdictions.
Dia, was this mostly Protestant clergy?
It was many mainline Protestant clergy. We found that there were, as we said, American Baptists, which is different from Southern Baptists, Presbyterians, Methodists, Lutherans, Episcopalians. There were also Jewish clergy. No Orthodox that we could find, but Reform, particularly, and some conservative
rabbis.
And we, as we did the research, we found that there were some nuns and priests who were involved. Usually they would actually help people get to the Protestant clergy for consultation, or sometimes the Protestant clergy would refer them to Catholic clergy they knew after the abortion had taken place if they felt like they needed follow-up counseling. So it was a fairly broad network of, in particular, Protestant denominations and Jewish rabbis as well.
And Pat, I guess all of this had to be done secretly, or was this an open secret, or was this something?
It was a very open secret, because the group in New York announced themselves with a front page article in the New York Times.
Okay, so that's not secret at all, right?
No, they had no way of knowing. And around the country, in other places, sometimes they were listed under abortion in the old, you know, yellow pages of the phone book, which was how you used to find services of all kinds. So they had no way of knowing if they would be targeted by the police, because what they were doing was they realized, at least on the margins of legality, if not actively illegal. And in Chicago, there was one rabbi who was not the target of an investigation. In fact, they of the entire probably as many as 3,000 clergy counselors, only three ever faced any illegal ramification. One was Rabbi Max Tichton, who was head of Hillel at University of Chicago and headed the Midwestern chapter. And he was got caught up in an investigation of a doctor in Detroit. He had referred a woman to this doctor. The woman turned out to be a Michigan State police officer undercover. So he was charged as...
What was he charged accessory. With?
Well, with accessory to abortion. However, the charges came to nothing. The doctor's charges also came to virtually nothing, and he wound up moving to Buffalo and doing abortions there once abortion was legalized in New York. So the charges came to nothing, but there was some court goings-on, and he had a lawyer in Detroit following his case and was advised by his lawyer not to travel to Michigan, but he said he may have snuck in a few times because he was in charge of some of the Hillel chapters that were in the state of Michigan.
And Dia, you said that a lot of them wonder about if you can tell us a little bit about thousands of women use this network. Were a lot of them, as you said, were a lot of them younger women, like college students, or probably ran the gamut?
So in the research that we've done, we found that it runs the gamut. So as I said, you know, some of the clergy who were brought, the issue was brought to their attention, worked on campuses. But the women were diverse in terms of age, ethnicity and race, religion. So we estimate conservatively that the clergy, when they were, the service, when it was active from 1967 to 1973, may have, and this is a conservative estimate based on the research of us, archival research and the research of others, upwards of 450,000 women between 1967 and 1973. And there was tremendous diversity, single women, married women, women of color, white women, Jewish women, Catholic women, Protestant women, women of all faiths, women of all gender, races, ethnicities, religions. So it was a fairly broad group. And the issue that they were very concerned about is clergy was also helping women who were, in particular, socioeconomically disadvantaged. They actually became, and Pat can talk more about this, she's very good about it, sort of a medical consumers union, in that when the clergy realized eventually the power of the number of referrals that they were doing and drove down the cost of abortions nationally.
Pat, can you add to that? Because I was wondering also about that, if women weren't able to afford them, how that also worked.
Well, they in Chicago, I should say, in particular, there was the rule that they should always refer out of state for legal reasons. Spencer Parsons, who was in charge in Chicago, reserved to himself the option to refer to a local doctor, Dr. T.R. M. Howard, who was a great civil rights activist and had been a friend of the Emmett Till family. He had a clinic on the West Side and did many of the low-cost abortions, especially for black women who couldn't afford to travel outside of the state. So most of the referrals were out of state, but he Spencer Parsons made sure that locally there was an option for low-income women. Eventually, in 1970, the law was reformed in New York State and abortion was made legal. The clergy themselves opened a clinic in New York City, and after that, many of the chapters around the country sent women to that clinic where they would perform abortions for as little as $25 for indigent women. So even with the travel expenses, often it was the least expensive route for them to go.
D.A., what inspired you and Pat to look into this issue and write this book?
We are both what I would describe as amateur scholars. I mean, we've been to school, but we just sort of stumbled across this topic. Pat went to a commemorative Roe v. Wade celebration when we both lived in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And this topic was brought up, and Pat and I both, you know, could consider ourselves activists in many movements and feminists, and neither one of us had ever heard anything about this group. And so after Pat described the service to me and this group, I said, well, I wonder if anyone's ever written anything about this group. And it turns out that there was a very slim volume that had been written by Reverend Howard Moody and his co-conspirator Arlene Carmen shortly after Roe v. Wade. And that was really the only monograph that specifically talked about the work of the Clergy Consultation Service. There were articles and other books that mentioned the group, but nothing specifically dedicated to the history of this group. And so, you know, we both consider ourselves to be people of faith and activists and feminists. And we just were thought, well, somebody needs to write this. And so we looked at each other and said, well, okay, let it be us. And so it became a labor of love. It's taken us about 15 years to actually go from inception of idea to publication of book.
And Pat, I wonder, as DA is talking about this, I wonder from your perspective, I'm just thinking also about all the conversations we're having now, particularly in Illinois with the Illinois legislature trying to pass laws that would preserve the legal right to have an abortion here in Illinois, regardless of federal law. I mean, we were talking about sort of 1967 versus now. Did you think when you were writing about this how much this might still be an issue today, Pat?
Well, we had hoped not. Even as we prepared the book for publication last year, we kind of assumed this would be just a needed footnote in history to make sure it was recorded. However, now it's beginning to look like a bit of a handbook and for activists today. And I think DA is better equipped to talk about the lessons that I think the Clergy Consultation Service have for us now.
DA?
Yeah, so we talk about the group as being a radical feminist populist group, and that is true, right? Especially because they were white, middle-class, middle-aged men for the most part, but they really were radical in that they advocated for the repeal of abortion law. They were populist in that they tried to serve women of all socioeconomic status, race, and ethnicities, and they were feminist. They really wanted to return power over abortion to women. And so lessons learned from that group, as well as women of color who talk about reproductive justice, that there really needs to be cross-movement activism around this topic. And, you know, we saw it within this group being activated around anti-war movement, civil rights movement. And I think that there is cross-movement possibilities, particularly for clergy, again, liberal clergy. We see that they've been active in the sanctuary movement, for example, and at various points from, you know, the legalization of Roe through now, clergy have talked about abortion access. But I think that there's an opportunity for, you know, inter-movement collaboration on rights across movements that could be reactivated. And, you know, this group shows an example of how that can happen, especially in terms of allyship or You know, you don't need to identify with the group to be advocates for social justice for that group. And I think that this group demonstrated that.
That's D.A. Dirks, along with Pat Relf, co-authors of a new book just out. It's called To Offer Compassion, A History of Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion. If you're in the Chicago area, D.A. is giving a book talk at the University of Chicago at the Seminary Co-op Bookstore at 6 o'clock. Pat, D.A., thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. So you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. That's all at our website, 21stshow.org. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to be talking about the role dirt plays in kids' lives with University of Chicago and Argonne scientist Jack Gilbert. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for tuning in.